Thank you, Steve, and hi, everybody. My name's Don, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm really, really grateful to be here. And for those of you that were here at the workshop today, y'all have already heard me say that I'm glad to be here, but for those of you who weren't, I'm really glad to be here. I've gotten to see some old friends, and that's been wonderful, and I've made some new friends, and I just want to say that the folks who put this conference together do a wonderful job. But maybe even more importantly, all of you folks who are here create a spirit that is just wonderful. It's just a great spirit to the conference. So thank you for letting me be a part of it. And what I'm going to try to do up here tonight is going to require some divine intervention. The first place it's going to require divine intervention is something's got to get me out of the way. I used to stand up to give an AA talk and say, if I can get me out of the way, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. Let me tell you something. If I could get me out of the way, I could be sitting in Kentucky watching a football game. I wouldn't need to be in Oregon at an AA meeting. By the grace of God, my sobriety date's April 9th, 1981. And I am no more capable of getting myself out of the way right tonight than I was in April 1981. I've got to have divine intervention. Next place I'm going to need some divine intervention is I'm going to try to follow directions. And now, this is going to surprise all of you, but my case is different. There's a little fella inside me who's a very special little fella. And he is the world's greatest expert on everything. Whether or not he and I know anything about it is completely beside the point. This little fellow is the world's greatest expert on everything. And he knows a lot of things. He knows, for instance, that the people who make the directions are just stone square Johns. Just absolute button-down conservatives. And they're being advised by liability lawyers who are worse than they are. So the people who make the directions overstate everything, this little fellow knows, in order to manipulate idiots into doing things. So a special fellow like myself naturally has to extrapolate as to what the directions really mean. And I've been so blessed in that regard because it requires absolutely no effort. In fact, I'm normally not aware of the process. It just happens. And all my life, if I have seen, or without divine intervention, if I see or hear some directions that say something like, do not exceed 6 in 24 hours, without divine intervention, that will actually register in my brain as meaning something like, do not exceed 36 in 24 hours. So we're going to need divine intervention there. And the good news is I found out that when I'll stick with you folks and when I'll stick with these steps that are our program of recovery, that divine intervention is pretty easy to get. And the directions that I hope to follow for a little while tonight are, of course, the ones we always talk about in a general way, what I was like and what happened and what I'm like now. And another set of directions that I love is the book tells me that my story will tell in my own language and from my own point of view how I've been able to form a relationship with my God. And I really hope my story carries that. Because when I got here, I was absolutely allergic to the God thing. The mention of it or the higher power made the little hairs stand up on the back of my neck. And it would insult my intellect. And it would run me out of the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm one of the ones who's so blessed. Because I was allowed to live long enough to keep getting run back in here by alcohol. Because I didn't have anywhere else to go. Until finally the miracle happened. And I was able to take the hand that you folks had been extending all along and let you lead me through these 12 steps that are our only program of recovery. And those steps led me to a loving God that I didn't even know was there for me. And that's the reason I'm alive today. So I really hope my story carries that. My body grew up on a tobacco farm down in southwestern Kentucky. The rest of me has been kind of dragging along, you know, growing up and growing old at the same time, which is probably better than never growing up at all. The main thing I'd say about my early life is that it wasn't a thing like I thought it was. Just not a thing. I was 37 when I got sober. And up until that time, I'm positive that I could have taken a lie detector test and the needle would never have wavered when I told you the saga. And it wasn't just a story, it was a saga. And my God, it was so interesting and romantic about how by my iron will and my sterling intellect, I had pulled myself up by the bootstraps from the depths of poverty to those staggering heights that I'd reached. And I believed that crap so sincerely that I would usually have you and me both crying before I was halfway done. And I wasn't sober a week when I realized that was all a bunch of crap. We weren't even poor. We weren't anywhere close to poor. We were middle-class farming people who had everything we needed and really most of the things we wanted. And you can be real sure that those heights were a whole lot more staggering than they were high. Both drunk and sober, I have to constantly struggle against being a legend in my own mind because my alcoholism is many things, and one of the many things it is, it's a disorder of superlatives. And what that means is that without divine intervention, I don't think in terms of even good and bad, much less ordinary. I think in terms of best and worst, just the absolute extremes. Now, when you couple that with another little problem of my alcoholism, it sometimes makes a mess. Because you see, without divine intervention, or without divine intervention, I believe that deep down, what I've always wanted to be is the best, if it wasn't too much trouble. Now, since being the best has pretty well always been too much trouble, without divine intervention, the thing that I want to be if I can't be the best is not second best. It's the worst. I want to stay just as far away from the middle as I possibly can. And the truth is that both drunk and sober, I've probably been a whole lot more just plain old garden variety than my ego's ever been able to stand. Another couple of things about what I was like. What was really going on, by the way, that first 12 or 13 years of my life was the selfishness, the self-centeredness. The book says that's the root of our troubles. My first sponsor explained that what that means is the first thing wrong with me is I've got a disorder of my ego. And that disorder of my ego makes me so obsessed with how I feel, so obsessed with how I believe I stack up against other people. The bottom line of my alcoholism is simply this. Without divine intervention, I'll always wind up letting how I feel be the most important thing in this world to me. Without divine intervention, I'll always get down to that when the chips are down, that how Don feels is the most important thing in the world to me. On account of that ego disorder and that obsession with myself, as far back as I can remember, that caused so much pain and so much emptiness down inside myself that I've never been able to stand the way I felt inside without either running as hard as I could or stuffing something in there or both to try to make me feel good enough inside that I could stand the way I felt. So the real truth, the first 12 or 13 years of my life, was that it was just a little kid on a normal farm trying real hard to stay a half a step ahead of a screaming fit because I was being pursued by the demons of my own self-centeredness. And those same demons are right there with me today. They're the same ones that pursue me without the divine intervention. On account of that ego disorder, I believe that's why I was never able to give any consideration to the possibility that there might be a power greater than myself that had anything to do with running my life on a daily basis. I didn't usually bill myself as an atheist. I would only do that if it made for a particularly good argument at the moment. I was usually okay with some sort of intellectual concept about a central intelligence or some sort of creative force. But when it got down to what my religious friends today, I believe, call a personal God, a God that's more important than anything else, including my brain, as far as the actual conducting and unfolding of every minute, of every hour, of every day of my life, my ego vetoed that and said, we cannot consider it. So for the first 37 years of my life, I didn't give any consideration to the possibility that that might exist. And very connected with that, I truly don't believe that I had any teachability or humility whatsoever until I got sober. And the reason I don't believe I did is I've never been able to remember a single time in that first 37 years that I ever voluntarily followed a suggestion that anybody made about how to run my life, unless I understood it and I agreed with it and I thought it would work. And you know, every time I say that, it's got a wonderful ring to it. Why in the world should I do something voluntarily about my life if I don't understand it, or I don't agree with it, or I don't think it'll work? When I get honest, it's simple. I've got a talking illness. My alcoholism's been running its mouth at me all my life, and I've always had an old crazy picture show rolling in the back of my head. And I want to tell you that over 25 years without a drink, a few thousand meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, several trips through the steps, has not made those things go away. My recovery has not been that my alcoholism has stopped talking to me, or that the old crazy picture show went dark in the back of my head. What my recovery has been is that most of the time I can recognize that they are not reality and I don't have to obey them. Most of the time I can chuckle at what goes on in the back of my head. And by the way, I believe that that alcoholism talking to me is connected with the single scariest thing about my alcoholism. In all the talking to me it's done in all these years, I don't believe it's ever tried to kill me. Now, I've nearly died from alcoholism dozens of times, and this is the terrifying thing. I don't believe my alcoholism cares whether I live or die. And I don't believe my alcoholism cares whether you live or die. I believe my alcoholism is the perfect sociopath. It's only got one reason for existing, and that's to try to get itself that next drink. And it'll tell me anything on the face of this earth in order to get it. It'll tell me something that might kill you, me, or both of us. It'll tell me totally inconsistent lies back to back with one another without ever dropping a stitch. It doesn't care. Slings it all up against the wall and hopes somebody will stick. Now, if 100% of the time I could tell that that's just my illness talking to me, and I could read the big book, go to a meeting, wash the dishes, whatever, instead of listening to that, that'd be fine. But my alcoholism is truly a many-splendored thing. I don't say this to be dramatic, and I really do honestly believe it. I don't believe there's any story of Don Major other than the story of alcoholism and the recovery from it. I truly believe that's all there is to me. And a big part of my alcoholism, of course, is that it's a disorder of my perception, which literally means I don't always see things right. I don't always hear them right. I don't always recognize them for what they are. So the bottom line is real simple. When I put the final say-so in the universe in my little old brain that I'm not going to do it unless I understand it, I agree with it, and I think it'll work, with what I've got wrong with me, I have just put myself under death sentence, because I'm going to wind up believing one of those deadly lies that my illness tells me, and I'm going to pick up a drink. And if I pick up that drink, I entertain a hope that I would come back and get sober again, but I don't really believe I would. And what I base that on is where I was with the progression of alcoholism the last time I checked on it in April of 81, and my own observation and what I know about people with long-term sobriety that pick up a drink of alcohol. I expect at my stage of sobriety, the odds are something like 2,000 to 1 that I would ever get any quality sobriety again. You'd think it'd work the other way. You'd think the longer a person was sober, the better chance they'd have of coming back if they relapsed, and that's not right. So you see, if I pick up that drink, I think that I'm going to die a mad dog death. I believe that with all my heart. So when I put that final veto in the universe in my brain, that's what I've done. In addition to that, I've just put the chief inmate in charge of the asylum. another quick thing about what I've always been like, and still am today without divine intervention, is I'm an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. I have always been perfectly capable of feeling too good for something or somebody and not nearly good enough for that same thing or that same person at the same time. It doesn't seem to bother me at all to harbor these totally conflicting thoughts and feelings. The only thing that I don't seem to be able to do without divine intervention is to feel okay with anything or anybody on the face of this earth. I've always known that I could do anything and at the same time known that I could really do nothing. It's always been there. And without divine intervention, it's right there today. So that's the mess I brought to my first drunk. I was 12 or 13 when I got drunk the first time, and that first night I got in an awful lot of trouble, and I puked, blacked out, passed out, woke up the next morning, had a terrible hangover, swore all those Baptists around there were right, and I would never do it again. And I was sincere, and it was really fairly effective because it was nearly a week until I got drunk the second time. And based on the way things were going to go for the next 25 years, that was a miracle. And, of course, what had happened, the magic had happened. But I didn't know the magic had happened. At the time, all I knew was that for a few minutes, on my way to puking and so on, I had passed through a right pleasant neighborhood. But looking back on it, of course it was magic. It was magic because, for the first time in my life, when I got enough of that stuff in me, I felt okay inside myself. It did something about that pain and that emptiness that obsession with myself had created. And since the bottom line of my illness is that I'm going to wind up letting how I feel be the most important thing in the universe, for the next 25 years, it was just real simple. When I wanted to change the way I felt badly enough, it didn't matter what it cost, and it didn't matter who it cost. Because without divine intervention, I'm going to let the way I feel be the most important thing in the universe to me. I'm not going to talk a whole lot about my drinking and the drunk log. I'll tell you enough to let you know that I didn't get here because it gave me the hiccups. From that first time I got drunk until I got sober about 25 years later, alcohol dominated everything in my life. Not just alcoholism, alcohol did. It's not a part of my story that I ever apologized for my drinking. It's not a part of my story that I ever hid my drinking. To the best of my knowledge, I never told myself or anybody else even once that I just was going to have a drink or two. I never wanted a drink or two. A drink or two never did anything for me except made me need something to drink. I'm confident that during the 25 years that I drank, I went to bed legally drunk at least 80% of the nights. Now, I had no idea I was drunk that much because the only standard for drunk I ever had was whether or not I blacked out. If I remembered everything, case closed, end of discussion, I was not drunk. The truth is that now that they've got that legal level down to 0.08, I probably woke up drunk 80% of the mornings. Also, by the time I was 15 or 16, I had figured out that if anybody stayed close enough to me long enough, they'd wind up blowing the whistle on my drinking. You know, they'd say something like, "Wait a minute, Don, there's a lot of good about you, and it gets really exciting being around you. But there's something really wrong here. There's something really wrong with the way you drink and the way you live. And we need to look at that. We need to talk about that." And when you did that, as everybody would, unless I could talk you out of it, you had just punched your ticket out of my life. Same simple reason. If you were going to, it didn't make any difference how much a part of me cared about you or loved you. If you were going to interfere with the only thing that I knew of that would make me feel the way I needed to feel, it didn't make any difference. I couldn't afford to have you in my life. And what I'm going to tell you about that now is not something I'm proud of, and I've had to do an awful lot of amends on account of it. But I believe for the last 20 years that I drank that I didn't even have people in my life because of that. I had positions. And whatever your position was in my life, I probably had your replacement interviewed at any given time because I knew the day was going to come that you were going to blow the whistle on my drinking. And I was going to have to get rid of you. School was very easy for me. And by the time I was 16, I had gotten in enough trouble that was about to fall down on my head on account of my drinking on one hand. And then on the egomaniac side, it was so clear that that farming community couldn't hold something as hot as I was, that I left high school early and grabbed a Greyhound bus and went 200 miles up to the big city of Louisville there in Kentucky. And I kicked around for 3 or 4 days, and I wound up on the doorstep of the University of Louisville. And they gave me several days of tests and let me in as an early admission student with an academic scholarship. The first semester I laid so drunk that I lost all concept of day and night. It was just a matter of passing out and coming to, and of course I blew the scholarship. So for the next 7.5 years, I worked full-time, drank full-time, went to school full-time, and somehow finished undergraduate in law school and have no idea how that happened. When I look back on that 8 years, I've got very few memories of it. It just feels like a whirling gray mass of alcoholic insanity. Spring of 1968, I graduated from law school. My daughter, Dana, who was my only child for over 20 years. Dana's 38 now, and my son, Keaton, is 17. But Dana was the only natural chick in the house for 21 years. Dana was born that same spring of 68. I started practicing law in downtown Louisville, and I practiced for about 10 years with a pretty good little bit of success at criminal defense law. I frequently say not nearly as much as I used to think I'd had, and I'm not just talking about when I was drinking. You know, if we stay sober a while, we begin to get a different focus and perspective on the past. And the first several years I was sober, I couldn't have been more sincere, and if it hadn't been for a little problem with booze and dope and some procrastination, I would probably have been greater than Clarence Darrow. I realize now that if I live and stay sober to be 30 or 35 years sober, I may find out I was a total failure. I don't know. But the best I do tonight was I was at least moderately, materially successful. I've always had a knack or something for getting involved in criminal cases that have got a high publicity value and got some money involved in them. And that's what I would stick in your face when you suggested that there was something wrong with somebody who lived as insanely as I did. And believe you, those 10 years from 68 to 78, I lived totally insanely. And it's part of my story that during those 10 years, I began to use a lot of things other than alcohol. And if you folks who were here today during the workshop know that I really, really do not want to be controversial. I really don't. What I said for those of you who weren't there, if you have caught me arguing with somebody in the last 20 years, somebody's been paying me. I will not argue with you and make my belly hurt for free. I will only do it when I'm paid. So I have no desire to stir controversy, and I understand exactly where the people who are so strong on the singleness of purpose coming from. And I agree with where they're coming from. We can't water down this thing. This thing of Alcoholics Anonymous is for alcoholics. But on the other hand, when I read the literature, Bill nor Bob either could tell their story without commenting on the other stuff that they took. So I don't feel particularly compelled to do so myself. And during those 10 years that I practiced law, I began to use a lot of things other than the booze, but they were sideshows to the booze. The booze was the big tent. They were things to change the effect of the booze, increase the effect, decrease the effect, help me try to function on the hangovers. But the booze was the main show. February 10th, 1978, I got full of scotch, cocaine, quaaludes, speed, and vodka. It was a Friday. And it didn't need to be Friday for that to happen to me. And in fact, very honestly, I'm going to tell you all about the 10th of February of 78, and there is nothing unusual about that day until I get to the wreck. Absolutely nothing unusual. It was just a normal day in my life. So I'm using all those things and thinking about how hard I've been working. At the time, I was remarried to my daughter's mother. Now, I frequently say that I believe that establishes my alcoholism without further authentication. Now, that's not because there's anything particularly wrong with my daughter's mama. It's just in the last 25 years, I've looked around and kind of observed, and I'll swear, I don't believe in the history of the world anybody ever did that but us. I believe if a normie even considered jumping right back in a frying pan they just got out of, they'd tear the door off the asylum getting in to try to protect themselves. And with us, it's routine, drunk and sober. You know, old Joe and Sue are divorced, but they're dating. They'll probably get back together. And the weird thing is it works for us sometimes. You know, it's not even bad. It's just real different. But at any rate, I was remarried to my daughter's mama, and it wasn't my daughter's mama that I got a hold of to go with me on my R&R trip. I had reservations up north of Louisville in French Lick, Indiana. I picked up my lady friend, took a handful of Quaaludes, got the two bottles of vodka I thought you had to have for a road trip in 78. I had a new Corvette with a built-in CB radio, so I headed southwest to southwest Kentucky to see my daddy. Remember, nothing's unusual till I get to the wreck. I got playing with the CB radio. There was ice on the road. That was a bad winter, that winter of 78 in Kentucky. I got to playing with CB, and I got hold of a truck driver. And he had some of those little old yellow Dizoxin speed beans, and he wanted some vodka. So we pulled over, and I gave him one of my bottles of vodka, and he gave me a handful of speed. And I made it another 50 miles and went off the road about 130. Did an awful lot of bad things. My body broke both legs, crushed both knees, lost the main artery in one lower leg, had to do a bypass in the upper leg, take out a vein, graft it in to replace the artery, and separated my pelvis and pulled my plumbing in two. So I didn't have a urinary function for over a year. Had a suprapubic catheter, they call it. It was just a plastic tube with a flange on it where they bore a hole in your abdomen, pop that sucker into your bladder where it'll carry your urine out to a bag. Try going a year without peeing sometimes. Uncomfortable. That first 6 months there, or first year after the wreck, I had a half dozen major surgeries, and I was in the hospital for more than 6 months during that first year. They took me to Vanderbilt because the wreck was down close to the Tennessee line. Took me to Vanderbilt University Hospital, and I stayed there for 5 or 6 weeks in and out of surgery and in intensive care all the time. But those people in Vanderbilt didn't know who I was. They didn't treat me with nearly the appropriate deference. So as soon as I was able, against medical advice, to leave with entourage, I got myself transferred back to Louisville. And I guess they, in some sort of sick way, they did know who I was, because I laid in the Louisville hospitals for months. And every single day, my friends brought me in booze and more dope than the doctors were giving me, and nobody ever said a single word to me about it. And I would lay in that hospital bed, and by the way, the prognosis on me early on was that I would never walk again without braces on both legs and one or two canes. And the doctors did not believe there was any possibility that we could find a surgeon anywhere that would attempt to find the ends of my plumbing and put them together so I'd ever pee again. Now, just for the record, and purely by the grace of God, because we know it wasn't me following directions, I've been sober about 25 and a half years, and I haven't owned a brace or a cane for over 26 and a half years. And about a year after that wreck, the head of urology down at Duke University did put my plumbing back together and restore my urinary function. But I didn't know that was going to happen. So I would lay in my hospital bed, and I would say really intelligent things. I would say things like, "You know, fellas, anybody can quit drinking when the going gets a little tough, but it takes a man to lay in there with it when the bills start coming in." And then I'd explain to him that a man ought not be out there doing the crime if he's not prepared to do the time. And just because we'd hit a little bump in the road, they weren't going to hear me whining. So give me another drink and let's go on with it. And that's real insanity. And that's real powerlessness. The young lady who was with me was hurt, but not nearly as bad as I was. She had on a seatbelt, for God's sake. And, of course, my daughter's mother divorced me finally, and I wound up, after the wreck, married to that young lady. I didn't go broke right away because a law firm of a few lawyers had built up around this other guy and myself, so some money kept coming in. And about a year after that wreck, I still had the tube in my belly and my catheter bag and my braces and my crutches, and I made my first trip to the asylum. And I don't use that word to be cute. Bill Wilson uses that word in the big book, and my mama used that word. When I was a kid in the country, they didn't talk about people having breakdowns and going to the hospital. They talked about people going crazy and being put in asylums, and I want to tell you that is far more descriptive of what kept happening to me. And by the time they got me in that first one, the phenomenon of craving that the big book, The Doctor's Opinion, talks about, and there's nothing mysterious about that. All in the world that is the physical addiction to ethyl alcohol. And the book tells us that every alcoholic either starts out with it or they develop it when through drinking, and then it progresses. And by the time I made that first trip to the asylum around the first of the year of 78 or 79, that had progressed in me to the point where once I started drinking, I had just physically lost the ability to stop myself from drinking. Most powerful physical force I've ever felt in my life was the last couple of hundred times I checked on that phenomenon of craving. And when something did intervene and help prise me loose from alcohol, it took 3 or 4 days for me to be physically able to do something like sit up in a chair. Well, they got me in that asylum, and for some reason they thought an AA meeting would be appropriate in my case. So they brought one in, and somebody got up and read the steps. Got to step 3, made a decision, turn our will and lives over to the care of God as we understood him, and that, of course, insulted my intellect. So I climbed up on my crutches and straightened up my catheter bag and said as loud as I could, "Do you mean to tell me there are people in this world who believe such crap?" Then I hobbled on over the telephone and called somebody to get me away from those religious fanatics before they somehow polluted my pristine intellect. Now, that was sometime around the first of the year of 79. I wound up getting sober about 2.5 years later in April of 81, but I really don't remember much of that. Some things that I do know happened are that I went back to the asylum 17 more times. I became addicted to hard narcotics. I became a needle street junkie. Real grateful for that, because that brought enough pressure on my law partners to cause them to kick me out of the law firm that I'd founded. And I proved that I wasn't going to make the decision that is bottom as long as I had a Timex watch. I certainly wasn't going to do it as long as I had a law firm. And let me just say something about bottom. You know, the first few years I was sober, bottom was so mysterious and frankly seemed unfair. It seemed like we alcoholics were like little dry leaves on the wind. And if we got blessed or lucky and got blown to bottom, it was just wonderful. We got to get in Alcoholics Anonymous and do the steps and make friends and get spiritual and make money and have sex and everything. It was just wonderful. But if you caught a bad updraft and couldn't get blown to bottom, well, you just had to die a mad dog death. And it seemed like a peculiar way for a loving God to set up a universe. And I know now that that's not what bottom is. And in sobriety, words are so important to me. Before I got sober, when I had formed an intention to do something, as far as I was concerned, I had made a decision. And I would tell you, I have made a decision, and I believe I had made a decision when I had formed an intention to do something. I'm very, very careful in sobriety. I don't call an intention a decision until I begin acting on it, because I've learned a wonderful, wonderful lesson. I don't make decisions with my brain. I think I do, but I make decisions with my feet. That's how I make decisions. And I don't set priorities with my brain. I think I do that too. But let me tell you something. If you want to know what Don Major's priorities are for the next 24 hours, for God's sake, don't ask me. I may try to tell you the truth, but I won't be able to. I'll tell you what I wish they were. I'll tell you what they ought to be. I'll tell you what I think they are. For goodness sakes, don't look at those hundreds of priorities lists that I've made in my life. If you want to know what my priorities are for the next 24 hours, you follow me. Every place I go, you watch everything I do, you listen to every word I say, and you will learn with 100% certainty, with no room for error, what my priorities are for the next 24 hours. Because I don't set those priorities with my head. I set those priorities with my feet. And going back to the bottom, I know now that bottom isn't an accident. It's a decision. Because you see, booze and dope were just my first bottom. I once calculated that I think I've hit bottom on the average of every 8 days for the last 25 years on something. And they are always the same. They are a decision, and by definition, I'm acting on it, that I'll do anything to keep from feeling the way I've been feeling and living the way I've been living. And when I've made that decision, by definition, acting on it, I've hit bottom. And until I've made it, I haven't hit bottom. But at any rate, back then I wasn't getting at bottom as long as I had anything. So right after the boys kicked me out of the law firm, state of Kentucky jerked my law license. My new wife had to leave me on account of the insanity. And during that period, she was staying with some girlfriends and died in an accident. I last laid eyes on my only child in January of 1980, and I didn't see or talk to Dana again for over 3 years. The Internal Revenue took my portion of the office building we built in downtown Louisville and a couple of things like that. The mortgage companies took the homes the ex-wives were in, and it was just all gone. And after everything material was gone, my dad was in his late 80s on the farm with nothing but his Social Security, and I stole that to keep on drinking on. My 15-year older sister, who was crippled from polio as a child, wonderful, spiritual, intelligent lady, loving, the last one that would accept a collect call from me, by the way. It took her longer than anybody else to write me off. I used her and abused her and endangered her life by continuing to use her. I burned up everybody and everything. And for almost a year and a half, up until the fall of 1980, I lived without an address. I lived on what I called the street and an expired Blue Cross Blue Shield card. And I lived every day of that with the conscious conviction that I had to die of alcoholism. And that's no mystery to me today, because you see, a good half of those asylums, I'm calling them, that I went to had treatment programs that were based on the 12 steps. And since I didn't have anywhere to go, if I was able, sometimes between trips to the asylum, I'd go to a whole lot of AA meetings. I had a head full of information about recovery and about Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, I was told that I had had enough information about AA for a couple of years before I got sober to stay sober a day at a time the rest of my life without learning one single new piece of alcoholics of information about Alcoholics Anonymous. What I didn't understand was that what was killing me wasn't what I knew and didn't know. What was killing me was what I was doing and what I wasn't doing. Had nothing to do with what I knew and what I didn't know. It was all my actions. But at any rate, during that 6 months between the time that I got to Nashville in the fall of 80, I washed up on the doorstep of asylum number 17 there. And I stayed in Nashville. I stayed in that asylum about 30 days, and it was time they had to kick me out. I lost my train of thought. Let me go back. I got it now. The reason that I believed I had to die of alcoholism was I had all this information about recovery, and it's one of my frequent and sincere prayers that I don't ever know as much about recovery or AA as I did before I could get sober. And I mean that prayer with all my heart. And what would happen during that year and a half is one of you guys would tell me how AA had saved your life and changed your life, and my brain would go, yeah, I know it works for y'all, but you don't understand how special my case is. You don't understand how intelligent I am. My God, I just see things more clearly than ordinary people, and I feel them so much more acutely that I'm wounded by my own understanding. My soul's just too big for my body, And Lord, of course I know I'm an alcoholic, and for that matter a dope fiend too, but don't you understand that those are just results or symptoms of what's really wrong? What's really wrong is so much bigger and so much more complex than that, and I wish I could be simple-minded like you folks and babble about your myth of a higher power and concentrate on those little symptoms and expect this terrible and magnificent things to go away. I was apt to get teary-eyed, so grateful it would work for you simple-minded people, but it couldn't work for me in my magnificence. Here's the nightmare. The very next heartbeat, one of you would tell me how AA saved your life and changed your life. And my brain, my alcoholism, they're one and the same, by the way, would go, yeah, I know, but you don't know about the parts of me that are just missing. You don't know how bad I am. You don't know that I've never been able to love anything or anybody, not even myself. You don't know that anything in my life that looks like it was okay, much less good, is some kind of pack of lies and a house of cards. And you don't know that I've never been able to be consistently responsible about one single thing in my entire life. And you guys have got people and things left to get sober with and to get sober for. You don't know how bad I've been. I've destroyed absolutely everything. If by some miracle I were to stay clean and sober for 2 or 3 months, it would just be to be blown into by a sawed-off shotgun or spend the rest of my life in the penitentiary. So it won't work for me because I'm so terrible. Very next heartbeat, it'd be back telling me it wouldn't work for me because I'm so magnificent. I was believing it both times. Well, I believe I got a lot better in the 6 months from when I hit Nashville in the fall of 80, and I got sober in the spring, in April of 81, and I believe I had to get better in order to grab hold of recovery. Now, that's not in the big book, but I really don't believe I had the capacity to do it. Something that's been on my mind the last few months, and I hadn't thought of it for 20 years, but 2, 3, and 4 months after I got sober, I'd go to meetings there in Nashville, and we'd go up to the Shoney's restaurant down the street from the clubhouse, and I would sit there night after night with my knife and fork under the table, watching my friends use a knife and fork to eat with and trying to practice and trying to somehow regain the skill of using a knife and fork. To say that I'd forgotten it doesn't cover it. It was just gone. It was just simply gone. So I think I had to get better. And during that 6 months, I did get better. During that 6 months, I went to an awful lot of meetings. Most of them at a club out there in Nashville called the 202 Club. And I got to where I could go as long as 2 or 3 weeks without getting ripped. And that was a world record for me, in or out of an asylum. I was a master at getting ripped in the asylum. And how I really know I got better is that during that 6 months, they only put me back in one rubber room, just one asylum. And at the rate I'd been going, I would have thought twice a year in the asylum was the picture of mental health. Well, late March of 89, I got on my most recent drunk, and it was another one of my pop-off vodka / Listerine drunks. And I have truly drunk a barrel of both those things, and quite honestly, I have better memories of the Listerine. And not just because you could get it 24 hours a day. Of course, that was its initial attraction. But I can stand to smell Listerine today, but I can't stand to smell that old pop-off. But on this most recent drunk, I was drinking everything I could find, taking everything I could find. And by the time April the 8th of 81 rolled around, I'd been drunk 10 days or 2 weeks, and I was sitting on the bed in the motel, on the edge of a bed in a motel in Nashville, and a loving God started giving me a lot of gifts. Now, during the first few weeks that I was sober, I had no idea there was any such thing as a loving God or that anything was giving me any gifts. Because, and this is really important to me, coming off that most recent drunk didn't feel any different than the 200 before it. I didn't feel a bit less too bad. I didn't feel a bit less too special. I wasn't a bit more convinced that I couldn't swallow this God stuff you all were preaching. If I had kept waiting until I believed that Alcoholics Anonymous would work for me, if I had kept waiting until it felt like it was working to start blindly doing what you people and that big book told me to do, I would have been rotting in a pauper's grave somewhere around Nashville, Tennessee, for more than 25 years. And I'm not guessing at that. I know it. The biggest gift my loving God had given me was the first tiny little bit of teachability or humility I'd ever had in my life. The first willingness to do some things that were suggested, even though I didn't understand them, I didn't agree with them, I didn't think they would work, and I certainly did not want to do them. And I had no idea that I had that gift. 3 or 4 days after that most recent drink, I stumbled back to that clubhouse in Nashville, and I didn't think they would let me in, and they shouldn't have let me in. They really should not have. They knew me well. I had passed out and had to be bodily carried out of their AA meetings there. They had caught me shooting dope in the men's room. They had warned the people they sponsored to stay away from me, that I was a loser and I was going to die. About 2 months before I got sober, I was walking through there, and a big old tall boy about 6'6", by the name of Joe Wall, Joe died a couple of years ago, bless his heart, walked up to me and said, "Don, I'm beginning to think you really are too intelligent for this program." And I thought he was giving me a compliment. My knee-jerk reaction was, well, thank God they have finally figured out who they're dealing with here. But Joe went on, and he said, "And you know, Don, that's a real shame, because we have never had anybody too dumb for this deal, and we bury you buttholes all time." And that felt like an icy hand grabbing hold of something inside me. And it was still there 2 months later when I stumbled back to that door. And they did let me in. I remember exactly what was said and who said it. They said, "Oh, yeah, Don, come on in. You are keeping us sober." And I said, "Will y'all tell me one more time what I need to do if I want to live?" And they said, "Sure, don't drink, don't take dope, and go to meetings." By the grace of God, first 60 days I was sober, I went to over 150 meetings. Now, during that 60 days, it was obvious to me that I was going to way too many of those fool meetings. It was clear to me they were doing little, if any, good. My brain was still assuring me that what we needed to do was get our head out of the sand, get our butt back to Louisville, get some money, get a law license, big car, good-looking woman, be somebody for heaven's sake. But I'd been given that beautiful gift I didn't know I had of being able to turn around to my brain and say, "Yeah, I know, partner, but you and I have nearly killed one another. And we don't have anything left to do but go to these dumb old meetings, although they can't possibly solve our special problems." And here's the sunshine. Those meetings worked just as well as if I had thought, felt, and believed they were exactly what I needed. I had it all backwards. I thought in order for it to work, I had to believe it would work. I thought it had to feel like it was working. In fact, I thought I had to be able to see the causal relationship of A causing B. Had nothing to do with it. All I needed to do was get my raggedy butt to meeting after meeting, let my old sick brain and soul get dragged in there kicking and screaming behind the raggedy butt. Then they told me if I wanted to live, I was going to have to read the big book. And I said, "I've read it several times." They said, "We know. You've been quoting it to us and criticizing the literary style while you've been dying, dummy." They said, "You've got it in your head that that book's some sort of philosophy book. And there's something in there you can learn or master that's going to somehow transport you to a sublime state of sobriety." They said, "Partner, it ain't going to happen." So there's nothing in that book or anywhere else you can learn that'll keep you sober for a heartbeat. In fact, they said, "Don't buy this crap that recovery's a learning process." They said, "You got to learn about that much." That's when they told me I'd known enough for 2 years to stay sober without any more information. That what was killing me was what I was doing and not doing, not what I knew and didn't know. And they told me, "If you want to live, Don, you better understand that this big book is not the solution to your alcoholism." And I said, "Wait a minute. You have been telling me for 2.5 years that the big book is the solution to my alcoholism." They said, "No, we haven't. We've been telling you that the action described in the big book is the solution to your alcoholism." And they said, "If you want to live, if you want to live, you better come back to that book like a little child and act like you've never laid eyes on it before and start at the front cover and go through it line for line, reading only the white part, rather the black part." My tendency is to read the white part, you know. And not interpreting one single thing, not memorizing anything, not arguing with anything, not distinguishing anything, not looking for anything to learn, but look for what it says do. They said, "Because what this book is not a philosophy book. It's a simple instruction manual for your actions. And what recovery is not a learning process. It's a doing process." It was at that point that they explained that the steps are the only program for recovery. In fact, steps are the only program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And be a member of the fellowship on any day I've got a desire to stop drinking. And thank God there's no other requirement. But unless I'm somewhere in the process of doing steps 1 through 9 the way the book says, or having done that, I'm living on 10, 11, and 12 in order to do that daily action that gets me my daily reprieve. You see, my reprieve isn't based on my spiritual condition. It's based on the action that is the maintenance of the spiritual condition. It's not how I am that gets me my reprieve. It's what I do that day. Regardless of how I feel like I am, if I'll do what I need to do to maintain my spiritual condition in that 24-hour period, I'm not going to take a drink of alcohol that day. The big book promises me that. But if I'm not doing that, I'm not even in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, just the fellowship. And I may stay dry a week or 30 years if I do it that way. But I won't have any healing of what's really wrong. That ego disorder, that inability to be comfortable inside myself, that disease, that letting how I feel be the most important thing in the universe. except the way as I do those steps. They explained to me that the steps are the prescription for alcoholism, that they work on alcoholism like an antibiotic, like penicillin works on an infection. They explained that if I've got an infection that's going to kill me, but will respond to penicillin, I don't need to go to the library and learn everything there is to know about the infection. I don't need to discuss my infection with all my friends and get their opinions on it. I don't need to understand one single thing about how penicillin works in the human body. I don't even need to believe that that little bottle of pills can take care of all these terrible things wrong with magnificent me. And here's the real kicker. I don't even need to want to take the pills. If I've got the infection and I take the pills as directed, I'll get just fine, thank you. And I was told, and my experience is absolutely borne out, that these steps work on alcoholism exactly the same way. They're the prescription for it. Then they told me if I wanted to live, I was going to have to get on my knees every morning and every night and ask a power greater than myself to get through the day without drinking and drugging and thank that power at night. Tears came to my eyes, and I said, I can't do that. The second step's what's killing me. I explained to him that I'd been trying for 2.5 years to make myself start thinking, feeling, and believing the way it looks like to me you guys think, feel, and believe. And I couldn't change anything. Not one thing could I change inside me. And I finally heard them when they said, Don, you've got that backwards too. We have never suggested that you think, feel, or believe anything. I'm sure my mouth fell open because at the core of my disordered ego is this insane conviction that what I think, feel, and believe is the center of the universe. My Lord, we can't have me doing something I don't feel like doing. That's so ingrained in me that if I wake up right now, 25 years sober, and I don't feel like doing what I need to do and needs to be done, and I know it's the right thing, every fiber of my being wants to do something like call one of y'all up and aggravate you. Dave, what can we do to make me feel like going to work so I can go to work? But you reckon I can do an inventory on it and that'll change the way I feel so I can go to work? What difference does it make whether I feel like going to work? I got to go to work. but you see, my brain doesn't work that way. My brain works, let's get some outside counseling. Let's do some good praying here. Let's get me to feeling like I want to do the right thing. And I've got some terrible news for you guys. In 25 years sober, I have prayed until I was blue in the face for God to change me and make me feel like doing right so I could do right. I have worried sponsors to distraction, talking to them about what we can do to get me to feel like doing right so I can do right. If we had all the inventories, they'd stack up somewhere between my knee and my hip, I'm sure. I've spent a few $1,000s on outside counseling trying to get me to feel like doing right so I can do right. Here's the horrible news. Not one single time has anything ever made me feel like doing right except going on and doing right when I don't feel like it. And I just absolutely hate that. It's more maturity than I nearly can stand. It's just awful. But at any rate, they said, no, Don, we'd never suggest you think, feel, or believe anything. They said, in the first place, you're way too sick to have any valid thoughts, feelings, or beliefs. They said, if you want to live, you get down on your knees and say the words, don't worry about what's going through your head because it won't count. And that's where that beautiful gift of that first little bit of teachability or humility came in. I don't know to this day why I did it. I guess it's just the grace of God. But over my brain's loud veto, sometime in April of 81, I started getting on my knees, 100% acting as if, and asking something that I didn't believe was there to do something I didn't believe that it would do even if it was there. And I kept on doing it, and I got compulsive about it. I've always suspected that one reason AA works so well is we get as compulsive about doing the right thing as we were about doing the wrong thing. I've always suspected that it gets that characteristic of ours turned around. And the miracle of the second step began to happen. I began to come to believe. And by the way, as far as I know, I haven't missed a morning or night getting on my knees since April of 81. And I'm not telling you that to tell you how great I am. I'm telling you that for an entirely different reason. I expect more than half the time I hadn't really wanted to get down there. A whole bunch of the time I could have gotten a medical excuse that I didn't feel like getting down there. I've had quite a few major surgeries sober. I've rolled out some hospital beds, and it's darned uncomfortable doing that, you know. Bunch of times I could have gotten affidavits from lawyers and judges that I didn't have time to do that. Whole bunch of times my brain's been spinning and I've been so obsessed and or scared about something that I couldn't remember the last word. I just tried to pray. And it was clear to me the words were bouncing off the walls and ceiling and it couldn't possibly be doing any good. But I've gotten down there every morning, every night, and something's worked every single day. And you see, I don't know any other way to stay sober. I don't tell guys I sponsor they have to do anything. But I do tell them, don't ask me how to stay sober without getting on your knees every morning and every night, because I hadn't got any clue. I've been absolutely unable to do it. They led me through the third step down there, finally got it through my head. It was just a decision, that it wasn't a great big process of God making me privy to the entire God's will, past and present in my life, that I couldn't go on spiritual cruise control and make policy. They finally got it through my head. The only glimpse of God's will I'll ever get is in the right now. That God is never going to share the pattern with me. Me trying to figure out the pattern is less fruitful than a chimpanzee trying to master quantum physics. I said during the workshop this afternoon, yesterday I turned 63 years old. I have probably spent 40% of my waking hours. I've probably spent 40% of my waking hours trying to figure out the pattern so I'll know where to start stitching. And not one single time have I ever figured out a pattern in my life correctly. Why I want to continue to waste my time doing it, I don't know. But that's God's job, the patterns. My job is stitching. And there's a little spark of the divine in me that will tell me where to stitch if I'll shut out my brain. And you know, the enemy of the right thing, the enemy of taking that stitch in the right place. At first I thought it would be things like greed and lust. And it is maybe 1% of the time. 99% of the time it's fear. It's fear that my brain telling me that if I take that stitch where my heart knows it needs to be taken, I won't get something I really want, or I'll lose something I really don't want to lose. So they led me through the third step. They explained to me that the third step, book promised us, would have little permanent effect unless it was followed at once by a fourth step. So having become as willing as I was, sure enough, at once, 8 months later, I started my fourth step. Of course, I didn't know I waited 8 months because I was working on it in my head. And my sponsor kept saying the silliest thing. He would say, Don, it's impossible to start a fourth step without a pencil and a piece of paper and a book open to page 64. And I'd say, yeah, but you don't understand. I got to get it straight in my mind. And finally he said, Don, you can't take your inventory. You've been trying all your life. Said, this is nothing new. He said, you have never found anything as all engrossing and enchanting as you. Said, you have spent your whole life trying to figure yourself out. What makes you tick? What's wrong with you? You can't do it. But said, if you'll come to that like a little child and you'll follow those simple instructions in that book, God in the book will do what you can't do. Your inventory will emerge. Led me through that. I did my fifth step, formed a picture of what a spiritual Don ought to look like. Blew right past 6 and 7, thought it was where with God's help I went to work on me to make me into what I decided a spiritual Don ought to be like. When I celebrated a year sober, I was living in an attic with no phone, no car, teeth rotten and out of my head, still unemployed and unemployable, happier than I'd ever been in my life. At about a year and a half sober, as a pure byproduct of steps 8 and 9, if it had been my objective to get a law license back, I don't think I'd ever gotten one. I think I'd probably gotten drunk and died. But I was really able to act like a fellow would act if it was truly my objective to do the 8th and 9th step in order to let it make me be of maximum service to God and the people around me. You know, none of these steps are really about us. They're all about fitting us to be of service to folks around us. My illness is self-centeredness. I cannot successfully treat it by obsession on self. It doesn't make any difference if I dress that up in psychological clothing. It doesn't make any difference if I dress it up in spiritual clothing. Me trying to deal with what's wrong with me by obsessing on myself is like trying to put out a fire with gasoline. It just simply will not work. I've got to let God take care of me and quit worrying so much about my raggedy butt and see what I can do for you. But in the process of doing 8 and 9, as a byproduct, my law license got put back in order. And in January of 83, when I was 21 months sober, I went back to Louisville just scared to death. If actually I've gotten a job in Nashville working as a clerk in a convenience store at minimum wage, I would never have gone back to Louisville. I didn't want to practice law. I didn't think these principles would work in the practice of law. I thought I knew how to practice criminal defense law. Didn't have a thing to do with these principles. I went back scared to death. Didn't think Louisville AA would work right. But I went to those dumb old Louisville AA meetings, and wasn't a month before I thought they might be even better than Nashville. And the second month I was in town, by God incidents, I talked at the Kentucky State Convention in front of 2,000 people. And people started saying nice things to me. Don, will you talk here? Will you be my sponsor? Will you do this? That same month, I saw Dana, my daughter, for the first time in over 3 years. 2 months later, Dana moved in with me, and she lived with me all through her high school years. And she's been in Al-Anon over 20 years, and she and I are dear friends today. And in the last 2.5 years, she's given me my first two blood grandchildren. And we were with her over Christmas, and it was just beautiful. We talk about program. We talk about 12-step work. When Dana moved in with me, she was an agnostic, and I just let her be, and that was a gift from God that I was able to do that. I just let her be. I didn't push her to Al-Anon. I didn't do any of that. And finally, the pain and the attraction, that wonderful combination, worked on Dana, and she came to Al-Anon. So all these things are going great for me. And I'm for making a little money, so I'm wearing decent clothes, and I'm driving a decent car. I've always gone to 4 or 5 meetings a week. I've always tried to do what I was asking Alcoholics Anonymous. And the first 9 years of my sobriety were, in fact, in many ways, just enchanted. They were wonderful. But the first 9 years of my sobriety, relationships with the opposite sex and financial chaos like to have killed me. They like to have beat me to death. And my God, I worked on them so hard. I did. I mean, and I, in good faith, guys, good faith. Whatever character defect was making my self-centered butt hurt, whatever character defect was inconsistent with this little self-determined objective that I dressed up in spiritual clothing and decided, therefore, it was not a self-determined objective, I would pray, I would grab that sucker by the collar, I'd slam it up against the wall, I'd use inventories, I'd use outside counseling, and I'd say, God, come here and give me a little help and we'll get rid of this thing. And God never showed up and I didn't know what was wrong. At 9 years sober, I was already becoming fairly busy as a first circuit speaker, and I was sponsoring 40 or 50 people. And I was dying inside. Cherry, my original sponsor, had died, and I'd gotten Tom B. from Avon Lake, Ohio, and Tom's still my primary sponsor. And I flew up to Cleveland to spend a weekend in May of 1990 when I was 9 years sober. There was an AA Akron golf tournament up there that weekend. I don't play golf, but it was an AA tournament for the folks in Akron and Cleveland. Tom had been sober 29 years, and they treated him like a newcomer. I met one old boy there that weekend who had drank with Dr. Bob. Tom had told him, apparently, he said, you know, I got this family coming up here, and he's really something. He thinks he's a hotshot circuit speaker and so on, and he doesn't know crap, and his ass is on fire, and he's coming up here for some help. And I didn't get out of the airport until one of those old clowns said, yeah, sober about 9 or 10 years. That's about the time most folks begin to look at steps 6 and 7. Well, it was clear to me that he didn't know who he was talking to. Because by that time, I'd listened somewhere between 50 and 75 fifth steps, sponsoring all those people. And by the time I left that weekend, I'd begun to realize. And that's another important word to me. I used to think knowing something and realizing it was the same thing. But realize is a form of the word real. That means that something has become real inside me. The things I've known for 30 years that I haven't realized. I could have quoted the 7-step prayer to you backwards. If you had sat down at a table to me and given me 5 minutes, I could have started at the last word and worked back to the first word. I knew it dead bang 100%. But I didn't realize that prayer really means what the ink on the paper says. It doesn't ask God to remove all my defects of character. It asks God to remove those that stand in the way of my usefulness to God and my fellows, and I haven't got a clue which ones they are. Not a clue. It turned out my problem with perfection isn't what I thought it was. I thought my problem was my inability to attain perfection, and I certainly am unable to attain perfection, but that's never mattered. I can't recognize perfection. You see, if God gave me the power right tonight, 25 years sober, to become anybody or anything that I thought I ought to be, I'd be like a blind dog in a butcher shop. I'd have no idea who and what I was supposed to be. None at all. Another thing, you know, I thought at 6 and 7 were where I went to work on me to make, with God's help, to make me into what I decided I ought to be. The 12 and 12, about the big book's got less than a half a page on 6 and 7. The 12 and 12's got a lot more on it. And the 12 and 12 quotes a big old book that's not conference material. The 12 and 12 says, "Of myself I'm nothing. The Father does the work." For 8 or 9 years, my brain edited that to read, "Of myself I'm not enough, and I've got to have some help from God." And let me tell you, that's not what it says. It says, "Of myself I'm nothing. The Father does the work." This deal isn't based on merit, and it's not based on psychology. This deal is based on grace. And I don't want to be controversial, but I will say this. Please, God, deliver me from issues. I don't want any issues in my life. And the reason I don't want any issues in my life is this. In the years I've been sober, I estimate that I've heard approximately 20,000 issues, you know, in enunciated. I've never heard a single issue that didn't fit right squarely into one of the three parts of the fourth step. It's either resentment, fear, or sexuality. And here's the bad part. Of those 20-odd thousand issues, I'm not aware of a single one that is satisfactorily and permanently resolved. So I don't know what in the world to do with issues. I don't want them. I want character defects. Book tells me just exactly what to do with character defects. And I know now that it's to come to my God and lay them at his or her feet and say, "Mom, Dad, I don't know where we are, how we got here, or where we're supposed to go, but I'm going to quit trying to figure out this pattern. You tell me where to stitch, and I'm going to start stumbling in that direction." I began doing that in May of 1990, and I'm going to wind up by talking a little bit about what's happened since May of 1990. If, when I was 9 years sober that month, if God had said, "Don, I am sick of your whining. There's a pencil and a piece of paper. I want you to list everything that you want in every area of your life." Every area. Your relationships with the opposite sex, Alcoholics Anonymous, your law practice, everything. Cars you drive, houses you live in, put it all in there. Write down the best you think it's possible for you to have, and I'm going to give it to you to shut you up. And I had made that list, and God had given me exactly what I had asked for. Please, please hear me on this. This isn't drama. It's just the quiet and loving truth. I would have shortchanged myself in every single area of my life. Every single area. I never dreamt of anything like that beautiful red-headed Sharon and I have had. Our wedding anniversary was December the 26th. 16 years. I sponsored some... I sponsor some counselors and psychologists, and those boys tell me that it's not healthy to have a relationship in which you don't argue. Well, they have their healthy relationship. I'm just fine with Sharon and Mance. Thank you. I do without the arguing. I never dreamt. My finances were so bad when I got sober. It was 3.5 years before my sponsor and my lawyer decided I could file bankruptcy without getting indicted. That's honest God truth. The form I filed was a Chapter 11 to pay back 100 cents over the dollars, and they had to litigate among the creditors for 4 or 5 years before they let me start doing that. So the month I was 15 years sober, I made the last payment on the financial wreckage of my past. When Sharon and I married 16 years ago, I couldn't buy a house. I couldn't have anything in my name. The old tax liens were still there. My God, we've got retirement accounts. We live in a house that's embarrassing. We drive whatever we want to. It's just unbelievable. Let me tell you the main thing got me out of debt. It wasn't working hard. It wasn't out thinking, out performing, and out maneuvering. There was a little lady that worked for another lawyer in our office, and I felt like that the guy she worked for was doing her real, real bad. He was going to take her car away from her that he had bought for her to go to work there if she didn't come up with $700 or $800, and that seemed so bad. So I went home to Sharon and I said, "Sharon, can we get that little girl $700-$800, just give it to her. Chair said, sure. I went in the next morning and I offered her it. She cried and she turned it down and said, no, thank you, that's the sweetest thing, but I'm not going to do that. About a month later, I'm in the office about 8 o'clock, phone rang, it was her, and she referred me a case that within 8 months I made a fee that was more money than I'd ever made in any 4 years in my life. And I did it with not a whole lot of work. Not because I was smart, not because I worked hard, because I did a little kindness. If I'll take care of you, if I'll try to help God's kids do what they need to have done for free and for fun because I want to, God will never fail to take care of me. Absolutely never. And the way this beautiful thing has worked this last 16 or 17 years, there hasn't been a single day in that 16 or 17 years that if you had asked me, Don, are you doing this well enough that it'll do any good, then I would have said, yeah, I think I am. On every day I said, no, man, I'm trying, but I'm screwing it up so bad. Because you see, still today, sometimes 50 to 100 times a day, I forget for a minute or a week that I ever did a third step, that I ever did a seventh step, that there's any such thing as an 11th step to live on. And I get knocked over by self-will. But thank God, so far I've always been able to get up and dust myself off and say, Mom, Dad, excuse me, I fouled up again. And stumble another couple of steps in that in the right direction. And I used to think that every time that happened, it was an interruption of my spiritual growth. But I know now that it's the only spiritual growth of which I'm capable. And it seems like my God is just real pleased with that. He or she doesn't require perfection from me, doesn't even require consistency. Real happy with persistence. And another thing, first year or two I was sober, I thought I had exhausted God's forgiveness, and I was on strict probation. And if I stepped a toe over the line, I was going to get squished like a bug, real uncomfortable. Well, I can't exhaust my God's forgiveness. I cannot exhaust it, and I need it every day in the smallest things and in the biggest things. Listen, I love everyone. Oh, in my law practice, I want to close by telling you this. When I got kicked out of the Kentucky Bar Association, it was loud, it was ugly, it was public, and there wasn't a self-respecting lawyer in Kentucky that would have peed on me if I was on fire. And they should not have. They should not have. About 14, 15 years ago, I get a call from a blue-chip law firm. I think, my God, what have I done? And I think, wait a minute, Don, you're not doing anything. So I call them back. And they said, Don, you know, we've got this committee called Citizens for Better Judges that interviews people that want to be judges, and we pass on whether they're qualified. You want to be a member of that committee? They later on made me chair of that committee. The Kentucky Bar Association called me and said, Don, why don't you come tell your story, those things that you thought you would never tell anybody. Come tell them at our state bar convention, and we're going to give people ethics credit for continuing legal education for listening to that. They said, Don, we need another master at the inner court. We've got people on the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. We've got the most powerful, richest lawyers in Kentucky, and judges, 23 of them. And we want a little drunk, criminal lawyer to come and sit as a master at the inner court. You can't get here from there. You cannot humanly do it. God does that. And then putting the cherry on the sundae, God has really got a sense of humor. About a year and a half ago, I was sitting in the barber chair, and my cell phone rang, and it was the president of the state bar, and he said, Don, we've got a vacancy on the ethics committee. For the first 10 years I practiced law, the only people on earth that I was more afraid of than the state bar ethics committee were the IRS and the FBI. So it is hilarious that I'm on it. You new people keep coming back. It doesn't make any difference whether you think it'll work in your special case or not. It will. Just do it. And it's the most wonderful, exciting way of life you can imagine. And I love every one of you. And thank you so much.